Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host,
Ariok.
Because we hop around between Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 with such skill on this show.
Yes.
Hello again, and welcome to episode 150. I'm Makalua as usual, and with me, of course, is Dan.
No more distracted than usual.
Yeah, right. Phil, or the Mian Team.
Aloha.
And Lisa.
Merhaba.
Wait, what?
He said hello in another language, so I get to say it in another language, too.
I'm surprised Dan didn't go for bonjour, then. And, of course, our guest co-host, Ariok.
Hello in English.
Dan didn't get the memo because you went first.
Dan just has to be different.
Eh?
Yeah, that's Canadian, in case you didn't know.
Oh, A is Canadian for hello?
Yeah, apparently.
A works for lots of things. Before we get into our quote-unquote normal topics, as if there's anything normal about this show, something that has been requested on and off ever since the show began are transcriptions. Polycast does have a YouTube channel, and in July there is actually going to be content there in the form of Polycast episodes going back to the start of our current season, Season 6. And the reason we're doing that is because there is a caption feature on YouTube videos, and although it is far from perfect, especially with the number of speakers we have and the different quality of microphones and the music in the background.
I look forward to the hilarity this is going to be.
I don't know how many of you have ever tried to put the captions on, like automatic captions on YouTube, but that can be an entertaining experience.
Yeah.
Starting with negative traits, thread started by Miles Beyond. This is in the Civ 4 general discussions thread. Anyway, a purely theoretical concept, since I've got the modding chops of a stone baboon, he begins. What do you people think of negative traits? Perhaps one per leader. Each faction had its pros and cons as one of its favorite aspects of Alpha Centauri, and yes, we all love Alpha Centauri. Mm-hmm. But with this transfer well on the Civ 4, and, you know, he goes on to make some suggestions, oppressive versus emancipator. I like the name emancipator, even though penalty to whipping would probably be really terrible. But, you know, it's a funny name, and it angers Dan, I'm sure. So, I wouldn't mind the emancipator being in the game.
If you're playing Washington, when a problem comes along, you cannot whip it.
Whip it good.
Yeah, and you just take a penalty for doing so.
This is kind of a quote-unquote easy answer. As Kid R says, I don't mind so long as the game is balanced, which is a very... I mean, we can say that about everything. What do you think about this? As long as it's balanced.
Must not like Default Civ 4 a whole lot, man. Or any Civ. Yeah. I've never played a balanced Civ, like since Civ 2 anyway.
Yeah, even in Alpha Centauri, it's not exactly balanced. Because there are some factions that are still just stronger than the others just because... And if you go to something like Master of Orion 2 or Galactic Civilizations where it lets you put your traits together, you can abuse the heck out of it. You know, if they let the players do it, it will be broken so bad it's not even funny. But if they try to do it and balance it, you're inevitably going to end up with one or two that are stronger than the others, just like Alpha Centauri.
Like, I'm assuming in this context the negative traits come with the quote-unquote positive traits, which also, depending upon the circumstance, sometimes a positive is just a neutral in the sense that, well, I really can't make use of it right now, or I can't make use of it anymore. So I'm assuming that with that balance includes that we're adding up negative traits, not just saying instead of positive traits, we just have negative traits instead.
I'm going back to Alpha Centauri again, but like you could be the university that had a really good science bonus, but you had a penalty to getting probed and you caused drones faster because they were mad scientists and weren't very ethical. You know, or he had the Sister Miriam and had the Believers faction. They were devout, so they were had that belief that they would go through battles. So the big bonus is on defense and stuff, but their science was crap because they didn't want to question things. Jeez, this, you can do it and have the positive and negative traits and have good flavor to it at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with the idea, certainly.
Just the
How about the stone baboon trait?
Yeah. The stone baboon trait. Derp, we can't do science, derp. We can throw big rocks at your head, though.
I mean, I remember there was a topic about a similar topic to this a few polycasts ago in terms of diplomacy, having civic, that would be the least favorite trait of a leader. Like Abraham Lincoln would least favorite trait would be like slavery, for example. So you would have like a diplomatic penalty in that trait if Abraham Lincoln were there.
We get that a little bit in Civilization V now with some of the later social policies. Yes. Where, oh, you've chosen this social policy, but here we prefer this negative diplomatic modifier.
No?
Yeah, or like if other people have emancipation in Civ 4. God, freaking emancipators.
It's in-game and out-of-game negative traits.
Although the AI doesn't care.
Because they're real civilizations, though, I think if you start giving them negative traits, I think people might take offense.
Yes.
That's true. I mean, there's already, you know, I mean, there's already a lot of things to be offended about in Civ in general, so... To say that, like, you know, for example, the imperialistic trait, I mean, people can take that as insulting, for sure. In fact, I think there's not very many people who would think imperialistic is positive in this day and age. Just
How about
strictly
the Terra map script?
That one's that one.
Why can't we start in the Americas and go conquer the bag in Asia and Europe, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
I think for that, people are raising the point about it, you know, based on real civilizations, yes, that these traits are tied to a leader, but you could have it set, you know, with random leaders. And it's interesting in the thread, Joko Mortar, who initially said, I don't think it's a good idea from a design perspective. You're making players choose between two things that will hinder them. After the discussion about, well, is there a way that we can balance this? Is there a way that we can incorporate this in a positive way? Suggests attaching, and I hadn't thought of this until he posted it, rather than having an entirely separate negative trait, just take the traits that we currently have, and in addition to the positive, give a negative. For example, aggressive. All buildings except monument produce minus one culture. And I'm thinking,
I'm not sure about that one.
I realize that it's an absolute value, so it has a more negative effect earlier in the game than later in the game, but, you know, you have to get through the earlier part of the game to get to the later game. Short of advanced starts...
If you're aggressive, why wouldn't things like a barracks or a stable be positive?
Or charismatic. Plus 25% war weariness. Like,
isn't that kind of the opposite effect?
Wow.
Ouch.
Ouch. That's... On a trait that's intended for war, that hurts.
Yeah.
This is why we can't have nice things.
That's exactly true.
Hey, you could do this properly. It's just that you wouldn't expect them to be able to do it. It's so hard. It's really hard to balance things. And like Mackie said, with picking traits like Massive Ryan, too, it gets even worse. But when you have a large number of traits, it's still possible, theoretically, to balance it. It's just difficult to avoid the really broken stuff from cropping up sooner or later. War weariness on charismatic. I mean, why have charismatic then? Why not just fight without charismatic?
Yeah, his idea of negatives for these traits is not the... it feels like kind of missing the point here. Why would the courthouse give industrious negative plus one sick? What?
Yeah, I like the idea of what he's going for, that our existing traits have a negative component to, but not these
specific examples aren't so great. Yeah, the idea is good, though.
Financial plus 10% city maintenance.
What? That's backwards.
Spiritual. Observatories give minus 10% science.
I can actually go for that one.
I mean, observatories, that's a pretty limited...
Yeah. Well, there might be maybe other more science buildings would not give you as much of a bonus or something. I don't know. Like, you'd get the culture from a library, but not the plus to science.
That would be terrible. Observatory would be doing, like, nothing. That would just be a drop in the bucket. You wouldn't even notice it most games. But losing the libraries would really hurt.
Or less science. You know, not zero
science.
Yeah,
but so early in the game, a small change means a lot. I mean, if you waited for, like, go down to 20 from 25% or something, okay, maybe. But otherwise, it's really painful. And 10% maintenance on financial is interesting because you have a fairly low base number that you're applying most of the time. So unless you have a ton of cities, you're not going to have that much problem. Like, if you hit the city cap on Immortal and don't build a courthouse, that's only going to cost you, like, 0.6. And that's on Immortal. that wouldn't be that horrible either, especially not compared to, like, the 25% warm awareness thing, or the worst one I heard out of our list is the negative culture per building, because you're just going to get swarmed by people. You almost have to kill them then right away, which is very problematic, since that's not always practical to do.
Yeah, come on. Even the Mongols were aggressive, but they left buildings and things behind that were important, like granaries and the barracks and stables and things like that.
Yeah, they just didn't leave people behind, but that's different. Why destroy the perfectly good buildings that they could populate later?
He doesn't have a specific for either imperialistic or protective. For imperialistic, he says, I got nothing. It shouldn't be something that inhibits expansion, though. And then for protective. Protective needs all the help it can get.
Can I beg to differ with him on that? Protective's pretty strong.
No, it's widely regarded as the weakest trait in the game, actually. I mean, it's annoying when the AI has it, but what do you do with protective using it? Are you going to try to attack people with archers? Are you just going to hit walls while you get pillaged? Aren't you
no, but if you start out in a bad situation player. In the game, like the Mao LP you just finished, it could save your butt.
Well, yes.
A cooperative game we had that managed to keep me in the game longer than I should have been before I died.
I guess, but it's still generally considered the weakest trait, at least in the most recent patch.
Talking about war economy, because all is fair in love and war, something like that. Anyway, this topic was started on Sith Fanatics by Vader 1941, or 1941. I don't really know. Why 1941? Is he like a World War II fan? Anyway, so this guy says that he likes to play Augustus for early game supremacy. And he's giving an example, basically, where he built 8 Praetoria. Praetoria, attacking somebody. that is the proper pluralization of Praetorian, I think.
Why are they even Praetorians in the first place? But continue.
Well, anyway, so he's basically saying, you know, should he re-tech a code of laws or math and currency? Code of laws would be 250 beakers, whereas math would be 250, currency would be 400 for a total of... How does 250 plus 400 equal 600? Come on. Come on, American.
What do you get when you multiply 6 by 9? 42. What?
Well, anyway, so he's trying to, you know, just avoid going on strike. So he's wondering whether he should go for code of laws or currency. Code of laws provides, you know, courthouses that are cheap. And currency, of course, you know, lets you have markets.
Well, here is the tip that somebody pointed out to me in the game. Once you get currency, you don't have to bother with building markets. You'll have excess cities that don't have anything to build. They can just build wealth, and that will start floating your economy back up while other stuff is recovering, while cities are coming out of revolt and things, and it will keep your army from bankrupting.
Plus, you don't now have to actually build anything. As soon as you have currency, boom, you have the additional trade routes. Plus, you can go right to moving all of your production over to wealth, like Mackie was saying. And that can actually then put you in a better position to do whatever the next is, which I suppose could then be go code of laws.
There's also the ability to extort or sell or beg, depending on relations and what your situation is, old from other AI as well. And a lot of times when an AI feels a wonder or something, it'll just be sitting on 500 some gold and be like, here, have currency for 500 gold or something.
And suddenly a huge bankroll for them.
Have 20, 30, 40 more turns at war before you go on strike, which is a big deal. It's all the time you need, really. To mention, you can power out a tech really quickly with that.
You know, Handle down below asks, says, makes a good point that mathematics will increase your returns from chopping and is on the way towards catapults because you can go for construction. If you have elephants, it might be worth going that way, math and then construction. However, he also points out he and Kallikrates, the code of laws will give you a religion. So, I mean, if it hasn't been discovered yet. So if you think that that might be useful, you know, if there are no religions nearby, maybe it's a useful, something that's practical.
One last alternative is to go alphabet and then currency. It costs a bit more, But with Alphabet, you can now extort text, you can trade Alphabet for text, and you can build research, which will let you get to things. Even if you can't allocate any commerce into research whatsoever, you can still get research that way. So that's another option. It's one that I will typically take if I'm truly desperate. Like I just archer rushed like 10 or more cities on Immortal. Okay, it's time to get something like that, just that you have a chance of digging out. Because you won't always be able to make currency in time then. At least not without Alphabet.
So there was something released for Civilizations. It's the last time we recorded an episode. I don't know. Something we haven't had in a little while.
Was there a thing released? What?
I don't know if it's really that big of a deal, but apparently the first expansion pack, or at least the first, maybe last, time will tell. Civilization V Gods and Kings was released on the 19th of June in North America and then worldwide otherwise on the 22nd. And for those who are still on the fence, certainly we've gotten lots of reviews from the gaming industry, the quote-unquote professional reviewers, along with those in the Civ community, Civ fans and maybe not so Civ fans, talking about their impressions of Gods and Kings. If you're not certain, there is a demo, and I know we had talked about, oh, oh my, there is no demo. There's not going to be a demo. It's for an expansion pack. Well, I guess 2K and Firaxis listened to us, and they went, ha, we're going to make you look like idiots. It's standalone, so you don't even have to have already owned Civilization V. And according to Civ Rules 07 on Civ Fanatics, who started the first social group for Polycast fans, thank you so much for doing that, by the way. I thank you again. He notes that there are two main menu options available, single player and options. When you choose single player, you can only choose play now, and you get the following setting, Boudica or Boudicea, however we want to pronounce it, baby, whatever, I don't know, whatever you want to go with, better. On Pangea, Tiny Map, Prince Difficulty, and Standard Speed, you can play against Attila, Dido, and William. That's Attila of the Huns, Dido of Carthage, and Willem of the Netherlands. So you're seeing four of the new nine civs that Gods and Kings introduced. Don't count Spain, because that was previously released DLC. You made it past turn 100 without a problem, so I'm not sure if there's a turn limit, but you can't save your game. And I thought, oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So if you're not certain if you want to spend the 30-some-odd dollars on it, there is that option. I have managed, I think, very well in the months leading up to Gods and King release, not talking about certain things, and all I can say is if you look in the credits, yes, the Daniel Dan Q Quick is me. It's not another one out there. So when I said at the beginning of the show that I'm not more distracted than usual, that's part of what I was referring to, seeing as how I was part of the testing of this expansion pack. And we're going to be talking about our first impressions of Gods and Kings momentarily. But first, if you've already purchased Gods and Kings and are wondering if you can get that money back, maybe you can, Mackie.
Over on Appleton, they're wanting people to try and write a review for the Gods and Kings. And they will pay you the whole 25, the best one. Submit it to them. They're plus the ones that are serious entries and not stupid entries. And you give thanks. This it's a credit type thing that they do on that forum. Whoever has the most thanks by July 11th, they'll give them the whole $25.19 because that's the cost of it on another site. It's not even on Steam cost. Guys, come on.
So yeah, this offer came to them from DL Gamer, which I had not heard of this place or seen this mentioned on a poll. And right now, as of this recording, I've only seen maybe 2, 3, 4 reviews or something like that. So your chances of winning is 1 in number of entries received. So chances are pretty good right now.
Especially if you're a good writer.
Indeed. Ariok's Civilization V analyst website. What was your experience with the Civ series and gaming otherwise?
Well, I've been a computer gamer for a long time. I've played Civilization since the first iteration and all the ones in between. I started the Civ V analyst just because primarily as a pre-release guide of information. The thing that interests me is before the Civilopedia is available, going through the news posts and the available screenshots and kind of parsing out sort of the intelligence on what the units are and what's available. And so that's how I got started with the site. I've done it for a few other games as well. I had a Homeworld site and briefly a whatever the Star Wars massively multiplayer was, massively multiplayer game was, which I've now forgotten.
Galaxies?
No, not Galaxies.
Old Republic.
Yes, Old Republic. There you go. So I do after the game's released, I do try to keep it current with the release date of the game. But once the game's out, anyone who wants to look at the Civilopedia can get that information. So it's the focus is usually in the 6 months or so before the game's released for me.
Well, I know for someone like myself, if there's something I want to look up quickly and I don't want to load the game to go into the Civilopedia, and yes, we talked about the Civilopedia online before, but sometimes just the way that you have the website organized, and I've gotten used to it because I went there before the game was released, and so now it's a habit. I'm a return visitor. I'm familiar with the layout. I'm familiar with what information you have there, and you're also very detailed in terms of your changes. I mean, you have kind of a too long didn't read version on the homepage, and then you have a more detailed change log, which is really nice because, especially for information that you've already published and then you've gone and changed, it may not strike you as, oh, that information has changed. Because I think sometimes when you read information and you go back over it over and over and over it again, you know, you're reading it, but you're not really reading it. Like you're seeing it and you're remembering what it was and you don't necessarily realize, hey, that's changed. So that's a nice feature.
Well, I kind of had to do that because for the Gods and Keys expansion, I put all the information in one huge single page, so kind of had to put a change log in so people could find what had changed. I specifically got a request for that.
On the site, then, you kind of address this in part. You say that the reason that you started the site was to track pre-release information about Civ 5 because you enjoy, like you said, trying to parse data out of screenshots and assembling a coherent picture of the game, and prior to just a few days before release, the information wasn't available anywhere else, or quote-unquote, or at the very least, it was available, but you'd have to go to this preview and that preview and this preview and that preview, and you just kind of bring it all into one location and coherently. So would you say that your aim was to indeed bring together information found in bits and pieces across multiple sources that you were putting together because you're trying to inform yourself anyway?
Yes, absolutely. It was something that I did for myself anyway, and since I had collected all the screenshots and had figured out, seen, you know, a unit that no one knew about in a corner of one screenshot, it made sense to put it all on a page so that everybody could see it.
How would you describe the Civilization V Analyst website to a Civ fan who had never been to your site before?
Well, more or less a representation of pretty much everything that's in the Civilopedia. Almost all of the information on the game, its features and the various units and buildings, etc. But again, compiled with an eye toward a pre-release list. So it's not quite as comprehensive as the Civilopedia, but it's more or less the same content.
You projected the site's lifespan at about 2 months, quote-unquote, at its outset. You talk about the history of it. That's nearing 2 years ago, so
yeah.
How do you regard the site's projected lifespan now? Or in other words, what's its future looking like?
Well, it's not going to go anywhere. I don't know how much new information is going to be. The continual adding of DLC has provided reason to update it. Obviously, the recent expansion was a major update from the original Civ 5 information. As long as they continue to update the game and there's something for me to change on the site, it will probably exist in some form, but it's not like I'm going to take it down. When I initially set up the site, it was only a few months before Civilization V was released, and so I knew that the pre-release aspect of it wasn't going to be that useful for very long. But Gods and Kings was announced like a good 6 months before it was actually released, so there was a fairly long time in which to analyze screenshots and previews. I think what it is pretty straightforward. It's just a Civilization reference, and now that the Gods and Kings expansion is out, not much more than a Civilopedia Online. As we've just been talking about, the Gods and Kings expansion is out, so what are our first impressions of the game? Should I start with my own?
Absolutely. You are the guest.
Ah, excellent. I was initially a little bit disappointed that the religion and espionage features weren't as beefy as perhaps they could have been. Especially espionage, I thought was pretty threadbare and almost kind of tacked on. But having played a couple games now, and it's an expansion, so perhaps I expected too much change. But I think the AI has improved a great deal. It still does silly things. But in general, there are a lot of small additions that really improve the game, I think, a good deal.
I'm actually not sure if any of my other fellow panelists have had an opportunity to play Gods and Kings yet.
Nope. Wow. It's all you right now.
All right. Well, you mentioned religion and espionage. I'm going to start with espionage just because there isn't as much to say about it, perhaps. I'm typically not the first civilization to enter the Renaissance era, but we know that that unlocks espionage for all players on the map. Though, if you are England, seeing as how you get that second spy, if you yourself push yourself to Renaissance a little earlier, then you're going to have that many more turns to take advantage of that second spy. But anyway, I would say that I'm always working in Civilization V to get and stay, if not the technological lead overall, then at least in one part of the technology tree I'm ahead, or at least at parity. And if I know or believe that I'm ahead, I use my first spy to counter espionage in the city that is most likely to take harm, i.e. your potential, which is based on the science output of the city, as well as defensive buildings contained in the city. So we're talking about your capital here. For my second and third spies that you get eventually as the game progresses, I like to place them in the city of my rival capital civilization, again, for that harm from potential. For intelligence, but not just limited to technology stealing, of course, there's the opportunity to get information about, oh, I'm about to be attacked, or my favorite, of course, is finding somebody else is going to be attacked, and then sharing that intelligence with that AI to get a very positive diplomatic boost. I will say, though, that I find that the rigging of elections in city-states is underpowered, both by AI spies and my own. So unless there's that rare circumstance where I'm fine with a rival civilization for a city-state I particularly value, I don't use that capability.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one, certainly.
With religion, I've mentioned before, I went with an extreme. I said, if I can't get Zoroastrianism because I like the icon, then I will rage quit. Well, okay, no, I haven't actually done that.
I'd rage quit. It's a cool icon.
I also like the Tengriism one, alternatively, so that would be my second choice. For pantheon beliefs, I like looking first at the terrain and the resources of my capital and my immediately surrounding region, which I've explored with a scout or two by that point, so I can take as much advantage as possible in this early game, again, based on where I'm located. I like to emphasize faith opportunity first, because I would like the pantheon to actually lead to a religion. Production second, happiness third, and then food. I put food fourth because food at this stage is a percentage as opposed to an absolute base, so I'm looking for something that gives me, in those immediate moments, the bigger bang for that pantheon choice. So, like, desert folklore, you know, plus one faith from desert tiles, and stone circles, plus two faith from quarries, or the goddess of festivals, plus one culture, and plus one faith for each wine and incense. But then there's gods of craftsmen and gods of the sea, plus one production in cities with population of three plus, the three or more, or plus one production from fishing boats, which was very helpful in my most recent game. And then there's, of course, sacred water with plus one happiness from cities on rivers, and plus one happiness from cities with a population of six or greatest from the goddess of love. And there's also the fertility rates, 10% faster growth rate. For founder beliefs, I emphasize gold first and then happiness second. And I'm not going to mention what these particular benefits are, because you can read about them. And, you know, we'd like the podcast to end at some point, I think. Initiation rites, church property, and tithe for gold. But then for the happiness, you also have the ceremonial burial option. And I'm essentially saying these also in order of what I would generally like. For founder beliefs, emphasize military first, happiness second, further faith third, and food fourth. So like holy warriors, oh man, that is so awesome. That has both saved me defensively from a very aggressive civilization. Actually, I think it's saved me more in terms of defense than going on the offense, but you could certainly use it that way as well. asceticism, divine inspiration, and then swords into plowshares, which is actually one of my favorite trait names. That's the faster growth rate for a city if not at war. And then if you get to an enhancer, I emphasize defense first and then further faith the second. Defender of the Faith, plus 20% combat near friendly cities that follow this religion. I wanted to mention that specifically. And then Messiah, with prophets 25% stronger and earth 25% less faith. We talked about all of these extensively before the game came out, but those are my favorites. I am really digging religion.
Yeah, I think it's a shame, though, that it's kind of the cost of units, the faith cost of units kind of escalates out of control once you get past the Renaissance era. And so, and the diplomatic bonuses, which I didn't really notice anyway, also decrease after the Renaissance. So it kind of fades out later in the game. I guess espionage was supposed to take over because it starts in the Renaissance, but I don't know if espionage is really strong enough to completely replace a religion.
I certainly don't find that it does. I mean, I make use of it, but my focus has very much been more religion over espionage. And really, in different respects, it was that way in Civilization IV, too.
Right. One last tip about religion regarding inquisitors and mercenaries and great prophets. One, this is in the Civilpedia, but it might not be obvious if you're just playing. Inquisitors can be used actively to wipe out an opposing religion from a city that consumes the inquisitor. But inquisitors can also be used passively. If you station one in a city, then someone else's missionaries and great prophets will not be able to spread religion to that city. The second thing, which might not be obvious, is if you can capture another civilization's inquisitors or missionaries or great prophets. But if you do that, you have to remember that those are still affiliated with the original religion. So if you try to use a captured missionary to spread religion in your city, you're going to be spreading someone else's religion.
Yes, and on the first point with regards to the inquisitors, it's that second benefit about stationing them inside a city with the prevention part that you mentioned that I prefer, as opposed to the inquisitor benefit otherwise, because if you get a great prophet, then it's an inquisitor in and of itself as well.
Right. Another caveat is that when you produce an inquisitor or a missionary, it takes the religion of whatever the majority religion of the city that you produce it in is. So I've heard many people say that this has happened to them, where an enemy, a great prophet, came in and converted their city, and then they built an inquisitor in that city to try to counteract the effects. But then when they used the inquisitor, it just opposite of what they expected happened, and they totally wiped out their own religion.
That's a very good point.
Be careful.
Be careful what inquisitor you wish for.
I did like that now the AI is a lot more capable, especially when it comes to building navies and deploying them as a group. I've had the Vikings send a very large naval force at me with embarked units and conduct an invasion, and that's something you would never have seen prior to the expansion.
Yes, very true. I still tend to prefer maps that have little water, that requires little to no naval units, just because really of the time involved, even at quick speed. But certainly now that knowing that the naval competence of the AI has improved, I'm hoping as time goes on, I'll be more willing to try it out. But I've been more about, okay, this is how I usually play. This is the type of maps that I usually play. Let's see how it's now changed with the Gods and Kings expansion. But I'm glad that you brought that up again, because it reminds me here on my summer vacation to actually try to go back to more water-based maps, which I'd essentially ruled out just because of the derpness of the AI.
Yeah, it was pretty useless. If you started on island before, there was almost no way that anyone was going to attack you.
Competently.
Yeah, yes.
They try, but...
They might declare war against you, but you weren't going to see very many units show up. I've also noticed that the diplomatic AI seems to be a little bit less randomly hostile. I have actually had a couple of games where I had a civilization that stayed friendly through the entire game, which almost never happened before. It was only a matter of time before someone was going to stab you in the back previously, repeatedly.
Do you remember which civ that was?
Well, it was Persia in one game. In my current game, I'm not through it all the way yet, but I have several different civilizations that have been friendly for a long time. Egypt, actually, Attila, he attacked me early, but we've been buddies ever since. I beat him up and said, don't do that again. So that part is definitely violent. Improved. Well, you know, Attila, you have to do that.
It's like a Monty. You beat him around and then suddenly you're your best friend.
That's funny you bring up Monty there, Mackie, because one of my recent games, Monty was friendly with me throughout the entire game, although I think he had a different personality because I did have random personalities on, so I'm not really sure it was Monty, but it was still amusing to have him be friendly. And as for Attila there, Jim, did he have that the diplomatic modifier, you have gone to war in the past, but they don't seem to hold a grudge? I love that, especially when they're the ones that oh, you don't hold a grudge, huh? Well, gee, maybe I do. Either you failed, I mean, ultimately it's your failure, but either I defended myself well and or you invaded poorly, and now you're back to friendly disposition, and it's like nothing ever happened in the last number of turns, and it's like, oh no, I'm remembering. And actually, with those diplomatic modifiers, now that we have the colors,
right,
the green and the red and the gray, in addition to the hierarchical order, you get kind of an idea of, even though we don't have the numbers that we had in Civilization 4, like +1, +2, +3, which I wish we actually had in Civ 5 still, I like this, that we get an idea of just how strong that is, because in diplomacy, like for declarations of friendship now, they have more meaning, because I'm not finding that the AI, man, I get declaration of friendships before, and then all of a sudden the AI that I just got a declaration of friendship with before it ended would denounce me, and then, oh, geez, your friends found reasons to denounce you.
Right.
I thought declarations of friendship are useless, and as a matter of fact, it's worse than being a zero. They're negative, because that would happen, right? And then I get, oh, massive declaration of war, because, oh, your friends found a reason to denounce you. You must be bad. Grr, arg.
Grr, arg.
Grr, arg.
Grr, arg.
Yarr.
So now for research agreements, although you can still alienate other rivals, of course, but I'm more likely to get into a declaration of friendship when I look at, first, the AI behavior, as well as, okay, you say you're friendly towards me. How has that friendly been constructed? You know, for example, if it's kind of precarious and, you know, it's like, we have no contested borders, but I'm thinking of expanding towards you, are you going to get annoyed enough that perhaps you're going to turn around and you're going to break that declaration of friendship before the research agreement finishes, which of course, yeah, I'm frustrated I'm not going to get the boost, but there is that gold. And, you know, depending upon your finances, you may think, no, I would rather hold on to that gold, even if it's for, you know, just having ability to, you know, deficit spend, as it were. But yeah, I like the diplomacy changes, in short. Oh, and love establishing an embassy with a rival civ to identify the location and size of their capital. It's one of those situations where it's better, I think, to a reciprocal. You accept an embassy in my capital, I'll accept an embassy of yours. Because if they offer you gold, it's pretty paltry. And I'd rather have the intel of where they are. Most of the time. I mean, if I already know where their capital is, well, okay, I might take the gold then. But
yeah, unfortunately, on higher levels, the other civs usually have writing and you don't. So they will, in the first round, they'll usually ask to place an embassy in your civ, and you can't get one in theirs yet, so they'll just give you the 25 gold.
You still at least get the positive diplomatic modifier. Ooh, we have an embassy in your capital. But yeah, you don't get that intel too, at least not right away. And then if you turn around and want that intel, then you give that gold back.
So the other big change was to city-states. The number of and complexity of quests that they can offer have increased significantly. And now instead of asking you to destroy a rival city-state, they'll ask you to threaten and bully the city-state, which for which you can actually get gold and perhaps a worker, which is nice. But I did find that you still have to, even though they now let you have multiple quests at one time, there's still a lot of times when you, and also you can use your spies to increase influence, although, as you said, it doesn't work all that well. There's still a lot of times when you're going to have to just give them gold bribes, and that has been, the effect of gold gifts has been reduced, and there's a diminishing returns effect, so the more bribes you give, the more they're going to cost to get the same amount of influence.
Compounded with that, you want to look at what their personality is. If it's a hostile city-state, yeah, unless perhaps they were only that type of city-state on the map and I felt I really needed it, I might be tempted then. Otherwise, it'll be, well, if I incidentally get some influence with you because I completed a quest either for somebody else or I was doing it on my own anyway, then that's great. I'm not going to worry about it. With city-states, the one thing about that, and you can, of course, watch for quests when gold gives you more influence, if you can time that either to get to friends or to get to allied status, or, oh, you know, I'm going to lose that allied or friend status in 20 turns, but more gold is more only effective for another 5, then I think, okay, I know I'm going to give you the gold a little sooner because in the end, I'm actually going to have more influence for a little longer. And yeah, you got to play around with the math somewhat in there. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. But I love bullying city-state. This is what I love. You bully a city-state to demand tribute through gold if or where possible. That's when they fear your military might. And I like that the interface, you don't have to go to each city-state inside to see whether or not they fear your military might. Just go to the drop-down menu there that lists the rival AIs and then the city-states, and then just hover over their icon, and they'll tell you they recognize your military strength.
Mm-hmm.
I've done this also, by the way. I've bullied them not only when I've been friends, but even when I've been allies. Huh. And you think, Dan, why in the heck would you do that? It seems counterintuitive, right? Okay, this is awesome. I love this. The gold that you demand, you can then turn around and give it back to them. That can increase your influence to a level higher than where you were at before you bullied them. I love it. The only caveat here is to watch the quests that they have active that Jim was getting at. If it's in a race that you're leading, for example, scientific discoveries, and, oh, you're leading and there are X number of turns left, or perhaps it's something, perhaps a quest is something that's peaceful that you can obtain further influence on, like, for example, connecting the road, wait for those quests to finish or complete that first, and then if you can still bully, great. But if you're not concerned about losing the quest access in that immediate moment, I absolutely love that you can bully them and then give their gold back, and then you're actually in a better position. I've managed to maintain friend and even allied status by doing that. And if you want to call that abuse, you go right ahead. I love it. I love it.
Right, but it will cancel the current quests if you bully them. So, as you say, you have to make sure there are no good quests that you're going to lose if you do that.
And out of the new two new city states, we've talked about Mercantile giving you additional happiness. They give you happiness resource plus either jewelry or porcelain, which you can only get from Mercantile city states. And then the Faith city states. The thing about Mercantile city states is those unique luxury resources, jewelry or porcelain, you can trade them to rival civilizations for gold. So now, to me, preferential to me for being friends, if not allied with, Mercantile jumps right to the top for those reasons.
Oh, yeah, it's a huge amount of happiness between Mercantile city-states and also being able to choose happiness-producing beliefs for religion. You can really crank up a lot of happiness. Usually, the only thing that prevents me from taking over the whole world is the happiness limit. And now I had one game where I basically conquered everyone except for Persia, who was my one friend in that game, and I had like plus 60 happiness. Well, after having conquered almost the entire world. So happiness, much less of an issue than it was previously.
The thing about religious city-states, though, and they're my second favorite, by the way, to befriend, find faith city-states. If you're the first there, you get plus 8 faith if you're the first civ to meet. But even if you're not, they'll give you 4. Well, so long as you haven't alienated city-states collectively through aggressive acts. Not that I found that out the hard way or anything like that. No.
Oh, Dan, you little warmonger.
Oh, Mackie, flattery will get you everywhere. Wait a minute.
Yes, using your scouts to find the religious city-states early will often give you enough faith to found a pantheon, so definitely worth seeking them out.
And if you keep ruins enabled, which I do, you may find the religious community, which gives you 40 faith instantly. Absolutely helps you towards a pantheon belief, or if you already have one, towards actually founding a religion.
Yep.
Maritime would be kind of my third favorite, or second favorite. I mean, it depends on what you're going for, how strong, you know, your religious background already is. And then cultured would be fourth, and they used to be number one. Sorry, cultured, but the Gods and Kings expansion really knocked you down there. And well, militaristic is 5, and I don't think we need to say anything more. It's like, yes, did you know that there are 5 different types of city-states in Civ 5? There's mercantile, religious, maritime, cultured, and militaristic. Well, that's kind of like my view towards them.
Well, militaristic did receive one little addition, which is there was always apparently a very small chance of receiving a unique unit from another civilization through a militaristic city-state, although it was such a small chance that few people actually saw it, that chance has apparently been increased significantly. So now you do have a pretty decent chance of getting a unique unit when the militaristic city-state gifts you a unit.
That's true. It does help. I would like to see with a militaristic city-state, like for instance, if you're friends or allies with them, going from friends to allies doesn't reduce the amount of turns that it will be until you get the next unit from them, right? Unless you tell them no units, so they don't want you to do that. So it's like, I like the unique thing, but if there was even, if you go to allied, then rather than having to wait 20 turns or 17 turns for, you know, the next unit, we'll knock that off by 10, 15, 20% or something like that. I might be more inclined to actually purposely try to go gain their favor, keep their favor.
Yeah, or if perhaps might be nice if you're allies, then they won't give units to anyone else, perhaps. That would be nice. Because
yes.
I do find it a little strange when I'm allied with a militaristic city-state and someone else's unit appears there. Also, another change is that the units they gift you now appear in your territory instead of at the city-state.
Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. I would say overall I do like that change.
Yeah, I think it's a good one.
We're now coming towards the end of the show. We have another announcement to make. We are saying goodbye to one of the regular co-hosts on Polycast. This person has been with us for 2.5 years and has lived more than half of her life as a co-host because as she constantly reminds us, she probably wasn't even born yet when the show began. And, of course, we're referring to Lisa Bang, QNL, and the reasons for it are time zone and otherwise changes in life. It's not because she got tired of us or anything like that.
No, just kidding.
She hasn't told us that anyway, regardless of whether it's the case.
We do have a replacement. We're not going to be announcing that replacement today. Lisa, you replaced Imran Siddiqui, who was on the show for 3 years, and you have lived through, for better or worse, our transition from a pre-recorded to a live format. I do have something for you, similar to what I did for Imran, but before we get to that, I did let Lisa know that I would like her to say a few words, so watch Lisa now say a few words and hand it back to me.
Well, I just want to say that it's been great to be on Polycast for 2.5 seasons. I've really enjoyed my time as a co-host, really immensely, through the release of, you know, Civ 5, you know, through the release of various DLCs, and of course, the release of various patches in Civ 4. Of course, I've also enjoyed spending time with my three co-hosts and all of the guest co-hosts that we've had. Well, almost all of the guest co-hosts that we've had. But, sure. I mean, you know, I won't say that I'm going to miss you because I want to come back and, of course, co-host sometime again, be a guest co-host sometime again. But I will miss spending every other Saturday recording this with Dan and Mackie and Phil because, you know, it's been a while and I've really gotten to know you guys. So, all I want to say is just thanks. Thanks for having me and thanks for listening.
You know, the first episode that you were on as a guest co-host was also the first episode that Phil was on, which was episode 76, so that's an interesting tie-in there. Oh, and even though she didn't say it, Jim, I know this is a little awkward, when she says she's enjoyed most of the guests, yeah, well...
Yeah, I figured she was talking.
What? Definitely not, but yeah.
Yeah, she just agreed. Definitely not. She's definitely not enjoyed you on the show.
No, I'm definitely not talking about you.
Oh, man.
Oh, did I take your words and twist them out of context for my own nefarious benefit? No.
Never.
Never.
This totally hasn't gone on the entire time she's been a regular co-host. Oh, no.
Never.
No, she meant every word we said.
Lisa Bang, Polycast regular co-host, January 2010 to June 2012.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
I'm Lisa
Alex's behalf, I would like to advocate to all our future guest co-hosts that not oversleeping is an excellent idea. It just generally speaking, you know.
If you live in a valley, you're still a valley girl, right? Is that not true?
All I know, Polycast, bringing people together.
Oh, yeah.
Lisa, Q and L?
Valley. Oh, my God. I don't want to do that.
We're keeping it. Yay.
No, 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 please. I beg you.
That was awesome.
And I'd like to thank you for a funny blooper.
Lisa's going to have to cancel her appointment to friend Joe 76593 and then friend Joe 7654. And, oh, she just doesn't have time to accept friend requests now.
Oh, you are not going to cut that Facebook thing out, are you? No, I'm just going to get, oh, God, no. Actually, no, watch that be on and then watch me get zero friend requests. That would be funny.
Lisa, what would you like our next topic to be?
I would like to talk about the Base Gun Rush, Alex.
Oh, okay. Did you say Alex?
Yeah, you're Canadian.
You don't take base
I kind of said, I don't know why I said it that way, so...
I don't know. Was it reference like to Alex Trebek or something? Like,
yes.
I'll take Mace and Rush for 100.
Yeah, say that.
I think, Lisa, you're actually suggesting to our audience that they start a fund to chip in to buy all of us copies of the game so we can start talking about it on the show. That's what I think you were getting.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right, Dan Q. That is a great idea. I mean, that I thought of course.
Technically, they've run the Inca in the poll, I'd like to point out. So we're getting away from alphabetical order here now because it's the Incas for some reason. He couldn't just put Inca.
V doesn't count in alphabetization, though.
But why did he put that?
You don't count articles. You don't count articles.
I know you don't, but why? If they didn't put, like, the Mongolia, why the Incas?
Like, the Ukraine.
That's not technically appropriate either. It's just Ukraine.
Well, you know, I mean, the Ukrainians say that, the Russians say something else, who cares? There are still stuff like, you know, the Virgin Islands, The Hague.
Is that an article or is that its actual name, though?
It's called The Hague.
Then at that point, you would be alphabetizing it by T.
Okay, yes.
It's not just Hague.
You wouldn't alphabetize the Virgin Islands that way. Or the Ivory Coast. Yeah, I guess silence means I win.
I just don't want to continue this discussion further.
Okay, you still sound better now?
No, you sound very muffled.
I sound very muffled, huh?
It sounds like you're in a car in a tunnel.
Yeah.
Is it better? Is it better?
Are you singing?
Where is the microphone in this? Oh my God. Wait a second. Is this the microphone? Can you hear me better now?
Oh, yes. That's way better.
That's way better.
Oh, awesome.
Where's the microphone? It's the thing with the microphone-looking device.
Yeah. No. Given the fun that you've had, though, we won't tease you too much. But we couldn't resist that, the initial reaction. We're jerks. Just, you know.
Yes, you guys are all jerks. This is why I've been spending 3 seasons, because I really love talking to jerks.
Oh, wow.
You found your true home.
I did.
All right, you know what? I'm just going to stop, because I don't want to take over the blooper reel again. I've done that too many times.
I don't think you've done it too many times.
You can never do it too many times.
There's no such thing. It's like you can't be too rich, can't be too thin. Can't have enough bloopers.
Yes.
Happy to be entertained and have friendly conversation.
Well, what about unfriendly?
Okay, guys, I'm going to have to take off now, and I think Phil has a thing.
Take
have
off
fun with your thing, Phil.
That was so...
Lisa, would you be willing to come back onto the show?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I will be much more on time. yeah, definitely.
You can't say no. It won't hurt her feelings.
No, I'd love to.
All right.
Aww.
Is that good, Lisa? Are you still speaking to me?
I think so.
She'll get back to you. I'll get back to you.
If you're looking up her name in the show, be sure to look for the Lisa T.
Eh?
Oh, because
never mind.
The bit about you correcting Phil about having the
Lisa.
I still remember that argument.
I was about to say, Lisa, did you remember any of those clips? Like, you started hearing it and you thought, oh, I remember how the rest of this goes, more or less.
I may or may not have been under the influence of... No, just kidding. Just kidding. I didn't...
Caffeine.
Oh, my. That's quite the confession.
What are you talking about? No, I'm just...
What are you talking about? That's a central element to the quality of the show of certain substances.
PUI, polycasting under the influence.
There you go. Mostly safe. Mostly. Still run for office later.
Oh, you got to be careful about polycasting under the influence. That's a floggable offense in St. Patrick's.
Oh, man. Dang. All right, I got to look up the code of laws right now. I do remember quite a few of these, you know, joking aside, though. And, yeah, tear.
I was going to say, they bring back some good memories because none of that has been heard by our audience before. None of that's been heard since it was originally recorded. And some of those clips were from when we pre-recorded, so nobody other than the panelists would have heard them.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Well,
so what, you're saying my on-time thing never made it into this show? Aw.
No, it didn't. It got cut before, so. That's why I save these things, because everybody leaves the show eventually, sad face.
Aw.
Thank you again for being with us for 2.5 seasons, and glad to know that you are both interested and available to be a guest co-host. I think that speaks volumes to how you leave the show as a regular co-host and the circumstances therein. So, let's see. Is you happy?
Yes. Well, of course, I'm a little sad to be leaving, but yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy. It was really sweet. Thank you, Dan.
You are welcome, Lisa. You deserve it.
Thank you. And thanks, Phil. Thanks, Mackie, for... Yeah, being
You're
here.
Welcome.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
But she should also just extend a brief thanks to Jim because...
Yes, thank you, Jim, for being our guest. You've been one of the better guests that we've had. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
It would have been kind of sucky if we had a weirdo guest. So, yeah. I mean, of course we never have those, but, you know, I'm just hypothesizing about... what.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Well, this has been Polycast episode 150. We have been joined today by our guest, Jim Francis.
Hey, it's been fun. Thanks for having me.
Our co-host, Philip Ballou, or the Me and Team.
So long, Lisa. It's been 2.5 years of fun and good times.
Makalua?
Yes, I'm going to miss you too. Now I'm outnumbered. It's a bunch of guys.
Oh, you're going to make me cry. Girl crying party. Girls playing crying.
Girls playing seven crying.
and, of course, our eminent co-host, Daniel Quick.
Every day I'm sibling.
Oh, no. We should not live in the free world. And of course myself. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yes, so I'll miss all you, everyone, and listeners. I think I said that like a million times. And yeah, keep sibbing. Keep on sibbing.
The next episode you're going to hear, because it's the summer and everyone loves Polycast so much, yep, we're going to have a quote-unquote bonus episode. Thank you, Lisa, for agreeing with me. Even though you're contractually required to, I still thank you.
What contract?
Episode 151 is going to be an archived episode with stuff that we cut from previous episodes. That means you're going to have 3 weeks in July of new Polycast episodes as our summer gift to you.
Get excited!
Are you going to start singing I'm So Excited I Just Can't Hide It, Lisa? Why, by all means,
no,
please
no, no,
do.
There's no singing
so
role in effect. Hey.
Okay. I'm sorry. She's laying down the law.
That's right.
Record date June 30th, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Party Rock Anthem by LMFAO clips, copyright Will.i.am. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.